Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host. We are visiting with a distinguished group of authorities and observers about some of the most important parts of what I think of as the battle space of the war for the free world. And our first guest is first in many respects. He is Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow and director of research at the Brookings Institution, the author of myriad books and countless articles and essays. He is a PhD from Princeton University and one of the guys that I think people all across the political spectrum turn to for a sense of what a sensible center position, maybe slightly to the left, is holding on various issues. And I happened to hear Michael this morning on National Public Radio and thought, well, it's high time we catch up with him and get a little bit more of a drill down on your thinking about what is the aftermath, Michael O'Hanlon, of this latest setback in Afghanistan for both the mission and perhaps the national interest.
Well, hi, Frank. Good morning, and thanks for the chance to be on your show and for the nice words. I think in regard to Afghanistan right now, it's obviously a tough week, and it's been a tough few months and, you know, a tough 11 years.
For that better, right?
Yeah, indeed. But I think that overall, my sense is that this terrible tragedy of Sunday's killings will not require any fundamental revision to the strategy from either direction, either the Afghan or the American direction. Now, I could be wrong in that judgment because there's obviously a psychological and political dynamic to this that is inherently hard to predict, and that's true on both sides. But the reason I make that claim is I think, as you well appreciate, we're in Afghanistan because we have interests there. The Afghans want us there because they know they can't go it alone yet, and those fundamental facts haven't changed. Now, the emotional toll being taken on leaders, the politics of this in both countries, those things can change. But we've sort of slogged through many previous debacles and tragedies, and I see no particular reason to think that this one will be any different, especially because, again, the Afghans recognize that while they want us out, they also still need us. And I think one very useful factoid to bear in mind is that Afghans, on balance, still like us a lot better than Iraqis did in 2007, 2008, when the surge succeeded there. In other words, common interest at some level can trump the immediate issues of personal affection and even trust. Now, I don't want to push the point too far. If the trust really breaks down systematically, then we'll have huge problems. But I'm still hopeful.
Michael O'Hanlon, let me come back to Iraq in a moment. But just on that point, would it not be fair to say that Iraqis may not have liked us when the surge was taking place, but they certainly recognized we were, as has been called, the strong horse, as opposed to today, when Afghans may like us a little bit more than Iraqis did at that moment, but are seeing us as a declining power? And specifically, Michael, would you address yourself to what the implications are for sort of staying the course, as you've described it, on the mission, both Afghan and U.S., of these so-called green-on-blue attacks?
Yeah, you know, they're terrible. And the loss of American and British and French and other coalition soldiers to these Afghan, whether they're imposters in some cases, whether they are psychotics who just don't control themselves, whether they are people with individual vendettas or some combination of all of the above, obviously it's had a huge impact. And the most clear proof of that is that General Allen, of course, temporarily pulled all of the mentors out of the Afghan ministries after the tragedy in which two were killed a few weeks ago. And that proved that he was worried about what was going on and the dynamics of what was happening. And as you know, the partnership and the mentoring are crucial in Afghanistan, perhaps even more than in Iraq, because Afghanistan is an even weaker state with even less human capital. And having suffered through 30 years of anarchy and, you know, sort of medieval rule, it needs our help even more just in running things. And while I think the Afghans are making headway, they're not yet ready to do this on their own. So I fully accept the point that the green on blue attacks have been a huge challenge. It was interesting. It sort of got only briefly noticed, but a few weeks ago there was mention in the press that the Afghan government, supported, I think, by ISAF and NATO, was deciding not to allow any more recruits to join the Afghan army and police if they had relatives in Pakistan, on the grounds that perhaps this made them more vulnerable to blackmail, coercion, indoctrination, what have you. That's the kind of reform that I think is going to be needed, because, you know, there probably won't be another case, heaven forbid, like this killing on Sunday, but there will be other green on blue incidents, and we've got to reduce their frequency and severity or this thing can't work.
Well, again, Michael O'Hanlon is our guest from the Brookings Institution, where he serves as the director of research. I guess if I could just draw you out once more on this question of the psychology. I mean, you've listed several reasons why these green types might attack the blue, but one that I wonder if it's not perhaps the most obvious is these guys are calculating the Taliban is coming back, and they're on the wrong side. And one way to get right with the Taliban is to attack and perhaps kill Americans or other allied forces.
It's possible, and that's certainly a reasonable explanation of why a certain group might try to do this. Let's say a group of insurgents that was not formally Taliban, but had some sympathies in that direction and was still sort of sitting the fence. But when it's an individual who essentially carries out a kamikaze or suicide mission because he winds up getting, you know, shot in the process of carrying out his atrocities or blows himself up, it's not clear to me that that person is thinking in long-term strategic terms. That person, you know, is in many cases, and as I think we've learned in examining some of these individual incidents, often carrying out an act of personal frustration and anger. I think you're right. The Taliban is going to still, some of these green on blue incidents have been Taliban infiltrators.
Yeah, no question. But I'm just wondering about, you know, the guy who whacked the two Americans in the Interior Ministry, for example, I think actually has gotten away. And maybe they get away, maybe they don't, maybe their families are taken care of. Michael, we're going to run out of time, and I've got so much I want to talk with you about. Can you just give me a minute burst? You've followed very closely the trajectory of the war in Iraq. Where are we now that the forces are all out of there, both with respect to our State Department presence there and which direction Iraq is going, with Iran breathing down its neck?
Well, we're certainly, as you know, at a delicate moment, and things are not quite as acute as they were just at the moment we left, when, of course, all of us were terrified by the sequence of events that had Prime Minister Maliki arresting or trying to arrest a number of his top fellow leaders, most of them Sunni, or virtually all in that period in December. And it almost looked like a coup of sorts, or a consolidation of his power, that he was profiting from the advantage of no longer having Americans pressuring him. And this just reinforced the worries that, in fact, we were leaving too soon. I would have preferred that we stay. I don't know that Iraqis gave us a choice, ultimately, when they denied our forces immunity provisions. And so in that regard, I was pushing all last spring, summer, fall for the administration to try to negotiate an ongoing deal to stay with U.S. forces. But once the Iraqis, who I think made the major part of the decision, once they said leave, I wasn't sure we had as much ability to stay as I would have liked. But in any event, that's an interesting debate. And of course, as you well know, many of my Iraq friends, frankly, on both sides of the aisle, are willing to criticize the administration for perhaps not having negotiated sort of enthusiastically enough on attempting to reach that deal. So, realizing we just have 1 minute, I think the one thing I would say is that in the last few weeks, things have been a little calmer. Good. Now, that doesn't mean they'll stay that way. I think Iraqis are jockeying for position and adjusting to the new power realities in the sort of, you know, relative vacuum of the American absence. And let's hope that it stays peaceful.
We'll be watching it closely.
More or less democratic,
With, I hope, your help, Michael O'Hanlon. Very quickly, now we have a minute left, the defense budget. You've written, of course, Wounded Giant, America's Armed Forces in an Age of Austerity. You've co-authored an important piece with our next guest, Mackenzie Eaglin. Just very quickly, Michael O'Hanlon, you've said the sequester would be a nightmare if these cuts were to come to pass. Is that a view that is generally shared by your colleagues at Brookings and perhaps elsewhere on the center left?
I think that there are people who would tolerate the deep cuts of the sequestration at Brookings, but I don't know anybody who likes what happened next year. In other words, the severity and abruptness of the kinds of cutbacks that would be mechanically imposed if sequestration were to occur and the effects that would have on the military. So there's a divergence of views. You know, I'm not in favor of the deeper cuts. Some people are, but nobody that I know of likes what would happen in 2013 under current law.
We look forward to, I hope, working with you to try to prevent that from happening. Michael O'Hanlon, thank you very much for joining us and for your expertise on all of these issues. We appreciate you appearing here periodically and hope you'll do so again very soon.
Sounds great. Sounds great.
Next up,
thank you very much.
We'll be speaking with the aforementioned Mackenzie Eaglin at the American Enterprise Institute. More on the defense budget and you. Straight ahead.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Congress doesn't have a budget for 2011, but the GOP has proposed a budget for 2012, and Bill Bennett likes it.
Maybe it helps to have that 2012 in the background, people hearing and seeing Ryan and the Republicans saying they're serious about really cutting the budget.
As a backdrop
to this debate about 2011, people make the decision, well, Republicans seem much more serious about this.
Bill Bennett's Morning in America, weekday mornings from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Mackenzie Eaglin, one of my all-time favorite guests and colleagues in the war for the free world. She has for many years been with the Heritage Foundation, now with the American Enterprise Institute. In both places, she has been one of the leading lights on national security policy and budget issues. Formerly worked for Senator Susan Collins, and prior to that for Congressman John Sweeney of New York. A woman who knows her way around the Pentagon as well, having served in the Puzzle Palace, as they call it, and has taught in numerous places, including the National Defense University. And she teaches me a lot every time we talk. And Mackenzie, I'm very glad to have you back. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you.
Well, there's a lot to be learning about at the moment. You and our previous guest, Michael O'Hanlon, published a piece. We talked a little bit about it with Michael, but you've really put the marker down with Congress, most especially, about the implications of yet another round of cuts, the so-called sequestration cuts. But before we go there, Mackenzie, tell us a little bit about, maybe anecdotally, if you would, the condition of the military today. You've written about the USS Essex, for example. Give us that story and what we might draw from it in terms of the underlying condition of the military that we're proposing to cut even more.
The
thank you. The last 3 years of defense cuts are starting to show stark signs of warning in the U.S. military. I've long been saying there's a readiness crisis facing those in uniform, not just in terms of the overwhelming number of deployments that are, you know, unsustainable for such a small group of people overseas, but also, you know, the things that they use every day, the hardware and equipment that is just wearing out and rusting. The USS Essex, a Navy ship, for example, highlights some of the challenges that the Navy and its sailors are facing.
What kind of ship is the Essex?
This is basically a transport ship that was found twice in the last year due to equipment and mechanical failures that it could not participate in a multinational exercise that the Navy was undertaking. And, you know, it's funny. This is just one of so many examples. You know, the Stop Kony video that's gone viral on the web is the irony of that and the Essex are that the commander of our Africa command was just on Capitol Hill last month saying he doesn't have enough forces to fight terrorists, including Joseph Kony, on the continent. You know, we're seeing this across the services. The Southern Command commander has said the same thing. He lacks the ships that he needs to fight the counter-drug and criminal organizations in Latin America.
And all of this, Mackenzie Eaglin, is assuredly going to become even worse if the next round of cuts, which is already being programmed by the Pentagon, goes into effect, to say nothing of this further $500 billion that has not yet been allocated, as best I can tell. Can you tell us what, as best you can judge it, the effect of another $500 billion might be should we find ourselves having to deal with contingencies in our own hemisphere or in Africa, let alone the Middle East or Asia?
Secretary Panetta was so shocking in his letter to Senator McCain last year when he outlined the devastating impact of additional $500 billion in defense cuts on top of all of those that have been already been taken, outlined this really devastating reality for the military, that saying, for example, we'll have under that scenario the smallest Navy since 1916 and the smallest Air Force since its inception. Frank, we already today have the smallest Navy since World War I and the smallest and oldest Air Force we've ever had since 1947. Add on to this the additional defense cuts that would come under sequestration, and basically what you do is the United States unilaterally dismantles its superpower status. The military, as stated by our own commanders, say they could not be in more than one place at one time or fight more than one war. That would truly fundamentally change our role in the world. Yeah. Overnight.
Well, and not least because historically we've found that bad guys take advantage of our inability to be in more than one place at a time. And Mackenzie Eaglin, one of the things that you've warned about with Michael O'Hanlon in your piece that appeared at CNN on its website was the implications of having to make the kinds of cuts that the Pentagon really hasn't yet owned up to partway through the next fiscal year. Now, for most of us who haven't any sense of how these things work, particularly in a huge organization like the Pentagon, you do. Give us a sense of what kind of mayhem that may wreak on just the business of providing for the business of defense, let alone, you know, actually defending us.
Sure. Let's go back to the awful debt ceiling deal that created this scenario, which was agreed to by the Speaker, the Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and President Obama, that really only forced conservatives to, make difficult choices. It was raise taxes or cut defense spending and cut the military. And all of the entitlement programs in the federal budget were fenced off and protected from any deal for any consideration of spending cuts, which is, of course, ridiculous since that's 2/3 of the federal budget. And what we see now is that deal is coming home to roost because the super committee failed and because Congress set up this bad deal with the president. Now we have these looming additional spending cuts that are automatic because they couldn't agree to them through the super committee. And the worst part about it is the fiscal year starts in October, as you know. The Pentagon and the military have not had a budget on time from Congress for the last 2 years. I'm sure that will continue. Sequestration is set to take effect in January, and yet Congress seems to think it has all kinds of time to fix this problem, when in reality it really doesn't. Members on both sides of the aisle have said, we will deal with this in the lame duck session after the elections. President Obama has been intransigent and insisting that he would veto any effort to undo sequestration if it doesn't include what he wants, which are tax hikes, massive tax hikes. And so what we have now is the military as a hostage to a larger political fight that's going to take place in the lame duck session over Bush tax cuts expiring, over the debt ceiling needing to be increased yet again at that time, a transportation bill that's going to also expire. And the military is the spending pawn in all of these debates and discussions.
In your piece with Michael O'Hanlon, you offer three examples of what might be required here. A 15% cut in military pay, a 20% cut in weapon systems, and a 25% cut in training and operations for the combatant commanders. If any of those had to be taken, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, you're, of course, a national security fellow there now, what would that mean in a practical way for the readiness, the likely ability to retain and recruit good people to serve in our military and our deterrent capacity?
You know, the signs of a hollow force are often hard to detect in its early stages and phases, but the training and the readiness accounts that would take a hit that you've highlighted, that is exactly what the type of spending that should not be cut when you're bringing down, you're reducing the size of the military pretty dramatically based on all of these Obama spending cuts. The steaming hours for the Navy, the going out to the training ranges for the Army and the Marine Corps, the diversification of, working on different types of weapons and systems and equipment, all of these
flying
things, flying hours, right, for pilots would be reduced. These are the things that keep the military ready for, you know, anything that comes their way beyond Afghanistan, you know, requirements on a daily basis, you know, that keeps them ready for things like Libya when we decide to launch a no-fly zone over another country. And those accounts have already been taking hits over the last 3 years, which have led to the readiness challenges. You know, the Navy has abandoned maintenance on so many of its ships, going back again to the Essex as one example. But it's across the fleet, cruisers and destroyers and submarines are all lacking critical maintenance due to funding cuts, which means your ship cannot steam. It has to stay home in dry dock until the money actually arrives. The readiness crisis would only get worse, and I fear that it's only a matter of time until, you know, something dramatic happens.
Well, listen, your warnings against it are deeply appreciated by all of us here at Secure Freedom Radio. Mackenzie Eaglin, thank you for expressing them to us, and for most especially urging that we can't wait for the lame ducks of December to fix this problem. Look to legislation like Buck McKeon's and John Kyle's and their respective bodies, the House and Senate, and let's get this fixed. Mackenzie, thanks for joining us. God bless you. Keep up the great work. Next up, we've got Congressman Ed Royce. We'll get his take on this Afghanistan mission and the terrorism threat straight ahead.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, parents. Finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi, son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak...
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, I'll fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
I'll pick you up after school. Okay, I got it.
It's easy to take a day for granted. You and your family are connected by routine, and you stick to it. But what if a disaster strikes without warning? What if life as you know it has completely turned on its head? What if your day's routine is disrupted and you can't reach your family? Have you planned for that? Before a disaster turns your family's world upside down, it's up to you to be ready. Get a kit. Make a plan. Be informed. Today. Learn how at www.ready.gov. Ready.gov. This message brought to you by the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the Ad Council.
You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I am very pleased to say, by a senior member of the House of Representatives, a man who has risen through the ranks and now is the chairman of a very important committee in the Foreign Affairs Committee with responsibility for terrorism, nonproliferation, and trade. He is also a member of the Subcommittee on Asia and the Pacific. His name is Congressman Ed Royce. He represents the 40th District of California from Orange County, now in his 10th term in Congress. And Mr. Chairman, great to have you with us. I know we're catching you on the fly during a recess work period, as they say. Thank you so much for coming aboard. You recently presided over a consideration and a unanimous vote in your subcommittee on a subject that I know is very much on your mind and certainly on mine and should be on all of ours, namely the threat that Iran poses in our own hemisphere. And we spoke with one of the lead sponsors of this, Jeff Duncan, your colleague, last week about it. But give us your take on the extent of the threat that we're confronting now from Iran in what I think of as our front yard.
Well, Frank, thank you. This is an issue that you've focused on for a long time, but I think just to go to the assessment of the Director of National Intelligence, as he stated in his testimony recently to Congress, he said, you know, the Iranian officials have changed their calculus, in his words, and are now willing to conduct an attack in the United States. And that's problem number one. Problem number two, as he spoke to the issue of the Iranian intelligence operation trying to penetrate and engage in this hemisphere. In the past, you and I, Frank, have talked about this situation with Hezbollah penetrating our border. And I mentioned in 06, I was in Haifa. I watched the damage that General Karani did in those rocket attacks on civilian populations in Haifa. I saw him.
This is in Israel, of course, coming from the rockets from Lebanon, or were they from Gaza?
Hezbollah from Lebanon, but the rockets were Syrian manufacture and Iranian manufacture. Now, here's my point. General Karani's brother is a fellow named Mahmoud Karani, who was trained by Iranian intelligence in terrorism, in explosives, in how to intercept messages. He was sent to the United States. He actually bribed his way from Beirut into the consulate and got a visa into Mexico, and then teamed up with a cartel there. They built him a special contraption in the trunk of a car. He came over the border and was finally caught, I think, up in the Michigan area, caught with about 50 of his fellow cell members. And so he's in federal penitentiary. The point is that Iran has had a long-standing policy of trying to penetrate the United States. And the reason this has concern for us is, you'll remember in the 90s, and so will your audience, the bombings in Argentina carried out by Iranian intelligence. And you've been following these threats where Hezbollah operatives have penetrated our borders. The Iranian attempt to assassinate the Saudi ambassador on U.S. soil using a Mexican drug cartel is the latest demonstration of this threat. And that's the same way, by the way, that Karani got into the country. And in recent years, you've got this other situation where Iran is developing these very close ties with leaders in the Western Hemisphere who are very anti-American. In other words, you see Ahmadinejad, you know, on his sixth visit of his tyrant's tour here, going back to Venezuela and Nicaragua, Cuba and Ecuador. And so you can see what's afoot. So there are many in Congress that are concerned that the administration has not adequately examined nor adequately sought to counter this. And we're concerned that Iran's growing and hostile diplomatic and intelligence presence in our hemisphere is predating Iranian action here.
And Congressman Ed Royce, assuming what you've said is probably not only true, but understating the gravity of the danger, you've recently, as I say, reported out of your subcommittee H.R. 3783, legislation that is designed to try to get such planning or such, preparations for the kinds of contingencies you've just described to get underway at long last in the State Department. First of all, why on earth is it necessary to do this legislatively? Shouldn't this be the kind of thing that the administration is doing anyway, either at the State Department or Defense or someplace? And second of all, what are the prospects for this particular piece of legislation? You say there's broad, seemingly bipartisan support to address these kinds of problems. Do you anticipate this will be enacted?
Well, of course, this is a big problem. The administration is not adequately countering Iran's hostile diplomatic presence here in the United States and in the Western Hemisphere, not sufficiently so, and that's why this legislation countering Iran and the Western Hemisphere Act of 2012 is important. It's why it's important that you're bringing it up, so that people who listen to the program will remind their members of the House or Senate that when we get this out of committee and out of the House, it's going to have to pass the United States Senate, because we've got to kick the bureaucracy into gear here. Now, the bill is going to force a strategy to deal with the threat, but the Senate's going to have to feel the heat of people in order to get this passed. So that's the last part of the question. What do we do to make sure it's passed? We talk to members of the Senate. We tell them this bill is coming. We'll get it out of the House. That's not going to be a problem. Getting it out of the Senate, we've got to put the heat on the Senate.
Okay. As you say, they've got to feel the heat in order to see the light on H.R. 3783, which deals with the threat of Iran in the Western Hemisphere. And Chairman Ed Royce has helped his committee begin to move this bill forward. We look forward to helping you get it all the way through, hopefully the entire Congress and to the President's desk, where I trust he would sign it. Let's come to another question, if we may, with you, Congressman Royce. In your portfolio as chairman of the Terrorism Subcommittee of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, you have to reckon not only with the Shiite threat of Sharia-adherent Islamists coming out of Iran and its proxies, but also that of the Sunni stripe, the most dangerous element of which, I would argue, is really the Muslim Brotherhood. The Obama administration has helped it come to power in a number of places, including in Egypt and perhaps shortly in Syria and elsewhere. And they're also very busily legitimating it here inside the United States. I'd really appreciate your thoughts on the advisability of doing so with an organization that we know from documents introduced in the evidence in the Holy Land Foundation trial has as its stated mission destroying Western civilization from within.
The entire focus, I think, on the part of Hamas is the same as the Muslim Brotherhood. And so if you look at the charter of the Muslim Brotherhood, which the administration should be, frankly, focused on that charter, focused on the imposition of Sharia, that is part of the goal of the Muslim Brotherhood. You compare that to Hamas's charter. Why are they so similar? Because the organization, is basically a chapter. Hamas is basically a chapter of the Muslim Brotherhood. It's the Palestinian chapter. I mean, this for us right now is one of the key challenges in the world today, is the growth of the power and influence of the Muslim Brotherhood and what they're trying to do to spread this ideology. And if you wonder what the after effects are going to be of setting up chapters, take a look at Hamas's activities, over the last 72 hours, in terms of the attacks on Israel. I mean, the reality is that this is a incredibly dangerous entity that is carrying out operations to put up chapters in the United States, in Europe, and is growing in influence and power throughout the Middle East. And it's very much in our interest to be working against the growth of the Muslim Brotherhood, not trying to engage it, but trying to prevent the domination of these countries through the Middle East by the Muslim Brotherhood.
And here at home. Amen. Congressman Ed Royce, we have to let you go. Thank you so much for finding some time for us here at Secure Freedom Radio. Godspeed on your work back in the district, and we look forward to having you back here in Washington and back on the air with us at Secure Freedom Radio again very soon. In the meantime, again, keep up the good work. Next up, Andy McCarthy joins us to talk about Afghanistan, Leon Panetta's contempt of Congress.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, couldn't hurt to call, and I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the MetaSystem. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The MetaSystem from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi. This is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a non-profit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of 3 children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a 5th grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a 5-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Is Nancy Pelosi looking to a higher power to get a balanced budget? Hugh Hewitt sets her straight.
When I hear you speak about this issue, of course, it's the Gospel of Matthew. When I was hungry, you gave me to eat and listen to
I just got to stop here. Nancy Pelosi quoting the Gospel of Matthew, as though that's got anything to do with the government. Let me just tell you, it doesn't.
Can I get an amen?
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as we have the distinct honor of being each week by Andy McCarthy. To my money, one of the great intellects and practitioners of national security and the law in our country today. He also has distinguished himself in recent years by writing several best-selling books, including Willful Blindness and The Grand Jihad, and truly innumerable essays, most of which appear at National Review Online. And I want to speak with you about one of those momentarily, Andy, but let me get your assessment. We've been sort of taking the temperature of most of our guests over the past couple of days about what happened over the weekend in Afghanistan when an American allegedly killed a number of innocent Afghan civilians in the dark of night, both with respect to anything you want to say about the event itself, of course, but much more importantly, what it means for the mission of the United States in that country, about which you have expressed some skepticism to date.
Yeah, well, I wrote, Frank, back in 2009 that I thought the mission was a real mistake, and that I really didn't understand. This was after studying General McChrystal's memorandum about the plan for Afghanistan. It seemed, and this is from somebody who has great respect for General McChrystal's patriotism and verve. I just did not see any sense in the mission. I didn't see that it was protecting our national security. I do think that they've done a good job of hunting down and and neutralizing terrorists, whether it's capturing and killing them. But I thought that the main mission that we needed to accomplish in Afghanistan was something that was accomplished within the first few months of being there. I've always thought it was a complete mistake. I think it's nothing more than a theory, and one that cuts against both logic and empirical evidence that turning country A into a democracy is going to make country B safer from terrorism. If your main threat is a transnational secretive terrorist organization that exploits the freedoms that are available in free societies in order to kill the citizens of free societies, then you can't apply the old doctrine logic that you know, turning a place into a democracy is going to make warfare less likely.
Well, and that, of course, Andy McCarthy, is especially true where the democracy in question in country A is one we helped establish under a constitution adherent to Sharia, which calls for all that bad stuff.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I also think that, you know, what happened over the weekend is a terrible event. It's actually not an unusual event in normal warfare, but this hasn't been normal warfare from the start. I think that Americans, while they're undoubtedly going to be shocked by this event because it'll get lots of press coverage, the thing that hasn't gotten any press coverage is the thing that's shocking to me, which is that the Obama administration has been basically pleading with the Taliban to come to the negotiating table and even offering to surrender to them the top al-Qaeda terrorists that we've been holding at Guantanamo for so many years and holding precisely because their freedom would endanger Americans. To me, that's a lot more offensive, even if it's not as grisly and sexy to the media as what happened over the weekend.
Yeah, no, I certainly hear you. Andy, let's talk a little bit about something that you did write about recently, namely Leon Panetta's remarks as Secretary of Defense before the Congress on a matter that really goes right to the heart of our Constitution, it seems to me, and I think to you.
Yeah, well, Mr. Panetta gave testimony. He's the Secretary of Defense, of course, gave testimony in the Senate Armed Services Committee before under questioning from Senator Jeff Sessions, who looked horrified and apoplectic, as I was, and I think as many of us were when we watched the testimony, where Panetta just flatly said that, you know, look, Congress is irrelevant. We don't need, well, that's not a quote, that's my characterization of it. But what he basically said is, we don't need permission or authorization from the people's representatives, who, by the way, would be expected to pay for any military misadventures, to intervene in Syria or, as I understood his theory, any place else on the planet. I don't suppose anybody ought to be surprised by that, because that was the position they took on Libya. And I, you know, not to be a broken record, but I complained about it then, so I guess I can't be too surprised about it now. But it was pretty bracing to hear the Secretary of Defense tell the Senate that the administration basically doesn't need the Senate.
Well, not only that they don't really need the Senate, they only need the permission of the international community, and that they may or may not even inform the Senate or rest of the Congress, depending on, I guess, how they feel about it.
Yeah, well, they did take, again, the same position that they took in Libya. In Libya, Frank, if you remember, they said that they didn't really need to go to Congress for authorization because they had already gone to the UN and the Arab League. And now Panetta says that if there was to be a Syria intervention, that, you know, they could accomplish what they needed to do in the way of legal legitimacy for the operation by going to the UN and to NATO. I would just stress two things to people. Number one, he's conflating two different doctrines. There's no question that the president has authority without congressional authorization to suppress enemies who either attack or have imminently threatened the United States. And there's also no question that politically, when we have a military operation that involves the interests of other countries and they want to align with us, it's a good thing politically to get some international legitimacy for that kind of alliance. But it has never been true, I don't think, that the president can unilaterally order military operations when American national interests are not at stake without authorization from Congress. And it should never, ever be the case that we need international approval to act in American interests when American interests are at stake.
Yeah. Andy, I couldn't agree with you more on both points, and I think your analysis is just right. Let me quickly ask you to turn to two other things. One is, you lay some of this at the feet of the lack of pushback, I guess, which you attribute, if I read you correctly, in part at least, to the seeming preeminence at the moment in Republican circles in the Congress of what you call the McCain wing of the party. You've joined the issue specifically with respect to the McCain wing of the party's enthusiasm at the moment for getting us into Syria. Give us a quick take on that, if you could.
Well, I think the McCain wing of the Republican Party are, they're Republicans, but they're transnational progressives, just like which is really the dominant center-left and left-leaning theory or approach that's followed by the State Department. So the fact that there's a strong component of the Republican Party that is signed on board for that probably isn't surprising, and the fact that it's the dominant one is the thing that's disappointing. But I think McCain essentially agrees with what Leon Panetta had to say this week, that basically when they decide American interests are at stake, even if there are no vital interests at stake, that the president should intervene, should get America involved in these operations, and the rest of the country should rally around that. And I just think that's a loopy theory.
Yeah. We'll visit a greater length about this debate that you've been having with some who disagree with you in the next round, if we may. But in what remains of this program, which is only about a minute, let me just ask you, what do you make of Eric Holder's efforts to block the use of just the kind of basic identification that's required to get a library book or to get access to your bank account or on an airplane?
How about a baseball cap at a ball game?
Okay, a baseball cap at the ball game.
I took my son to a Met game and I bought him a Met hat with a credit card, and the woman asked me for identification.
Well, there you go.
I didn't think it was any. I wasn't insulted. I didn't feel like I was put upon. Look, Frank, I think that Holder is carrying out Obama's policy, which is what he's been doing from the beginning. These people came to fundamentally change America. And one of the ways they are fundamentally changing America is lowering the standards for people who can vote, so that the votes of actual Americans are basically watered down. And we have, elements that are allied with the administration carrying the day. And if you're going to vote for this administration and its policies, they don't really particularly care if you're eligible or not.
There you go. And this is the Chicago way, after all. Well, we'll be following this closely with you, as I'm sure all of us will. Andy, thanks so much for joining us, as always. Talk with you again next week, and hopefully talk to the rest of you tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.